Even now, as we turn to your word, would you be famous in our hearts? And as we look at Job, continue to give us endurance in this middle section that is dark and full of sorrow. So awaken faith and put forth its strength in us until all heaven fills our soul and all impurity is cast out. Teach us, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen. Job chapter 10. I've forgotten where I have read this quote, but I did read it at some time in some book. How's that for being helpful? It was during a particular season, I believe, as I was trying to finish seminary and had five classes, and each class had assigned four or five different textbooks, and it was in one of the fog of all of that semester coming back. But this is how this individual author opened the book with this illustration. The book was about suffering. I have a friend who has a dog named Bailey. Bailey was a two-year-old basset hound who had a gentle, playful temper, eager to love anyone near him. But though this is true, Bailey has a bit of baggage. You see, Bailey was just a puppy when an F5 tornado came through his backyard and he just happened to be playing in it. He survived. My friend got to him in time, but it left a mark on Bailey that has never left. So deep a mark that any time a storm comes to Bailey's house and Bailey is in the backyard, he freaks out, runs to the back door, and barks his tail off until someone comes to his rescue. It could just be a few raindrops and no big deal to any normal person, but to Bailey, it's the apocalypse. A few years after this incident, wildfires were roaring about my friend's home, and it did eventually catch on fire and burn down. But the important thing to notice about this fire is that it came to my friend's house through the backyard, where Bailey happened to be playing again. My friend saw it, ran outside just in time to see his trees light up like fireballs, grabbed Bailey, and got to safety. During the time that a new house was being rebuilt for our friends, they stayed in a little condo close by, and as soon as they got into the condo, Bailey had a moment. He walked in, sniffed around, found the bedroom, jumped onto the bed, found my friend's pillow, and proceeded to pee. My friend knew what this meant. Bailey clearly felt the need to make a few things clear. First, he acknowledged that my friend was indeed the head of the family. He chose his pillow to pee on rather than the others. Second, he was not running away. He was still happily part of the family, knowing he's loved and cared for, but he wanted to make it known that to him, his little life was out of control and he didn't know what to do. He had been chased by not only an F5 tornado, but a blazing fire, and now his home had been destroyed twice. He couldn't hold it in any longer. He had to let out his feelings and make it known that he was not happy. Sad doggy, huh? So, I tell you that story because when we go through tornadoes and blazing fires in our own lives, we often do the same thing that Bailey does. Hopefully we're not peeing on pillows, but we do act out in similar yet different ways. When times like this happen to us, we can easily feel displaced, frustrated, confused, angry, and eventually, if we remain in this condition long enough, we will crack. We will crack. I believe that Job has cracked in chapter 3 when he lamented out loud to no one, not even to God. He's just speaking out of his suffering. And the evidence of that cracking is woven all throughout chapters 3 and beyond. And especially as we get to chapter 10, Job had been in chapter 9 responding to Bildad, but in chapter 10 it reaches a new level of intensity. speaking to God directly in chapter 10, verse 1, as words flow out of his mouth, we see his cracked heart coming through clearly in questions, dire questions. There are four of them, and we'll go through one at a time. Question one, why are you against me? Verse 1 to 3, why are you against me? I loathe my life. I will give free utterance to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. I will say to God, do not condemn me. Let me know why you contend against me. Does it seem good to you to oppress, to despise the work of your hands and favor the designs of the wicked? The matter at hand before us in verse 1 to 3 is Job's struggle to interpret his life correctly in the midst of his current suffering. Job will no longer talk about God to his friends. No, in verse 1, we see that Job will no longer put a cage on his mouth and restrain what he's feeling. And he will speak out of the cracked, broken nature of his heart. And he will ask God about the deepest questions that he can possibly fathom. Questions that are on the surface of things unanswerable. This first question really comes to us in verse 2, where we see Job's belief that God has condemned him and is now contending against him. Because of this, Job loathes his life, verse 1. More so in verse 3, more questions come from this concerning the very nature of God. Does God find it an exercise of enjoyment to oppress and despise the work of his hands? Or does God favor, or literally in the Hebrew, smile upon the designs of the wicked? We know the answers to this question. We know the answers to these questions in verse 3. We are aware that God does not favor or smile at the designs of the wicked, that God does not oppress and despise the work of his hands, and that God is not condemning nor contending against Job. So why does Job ask these things? Because he is suffering. And as far as he can tell, regardless of what his friends keep telling him, he can't seem to find a reason for why he's suffering. Remember, his friends are telling him that he's the reason. He doesn't believe there is a reason why he's suffering. So why can we see what Job cannot see? Well, that also is an easy question to answer. First, we're not suffering as he is. We're not in his shoes. We've been given, second, a window behind the curtain that Job has not been allowed to see. All of this shows us something that will aid us in our own suffering and aid us in speaking to those who are suffering themselves. Suffering can fog what is clear, such that we can call into question in suffering those things that we once thought concrete. This is what's happening to Job. His suffering is fogging his view of God, and while he's in the midst of it, it's very difficult for him to see as he ought to see. Now, this aids us in our own suffering by reminding us that when we suffer, we have to get people around us that will remind us of what is true, even though we can't see it. The sun still shines when the clouds are out. And when we are cloudy, we need friends who are filled with sunshine that will talk about its brightness and its warmth. We'll need others to remind us that this fog is temporary, and it will one day, in God's timing, lift, and the beams of light will disperse the clouds. We need others, really, that will remind us what is good, true, and beautiful. And doesn't this also aid us in speaking to those who are suffering? when they're fogged, we need to be the ones who remind them of what is good, what is true, and what is beautiful. Job's friends should have been doing this, but by blaming Job for the things that are happening to him, they only added more weight onto his already heavy burden, rather than giving him some kind of relief. So this is question one. Why are you against me? Question two comes in verse 4-7. Why do you watch me? Have you eyes of flesh? Do you see as man sees? Are your days as the days of man, or your years as a man's years, that you seek out my iniquity and search for my sin, although you know that I am not guilty, and there is none to deliver out of your hand? Job here asks God if he has eyes like a man, and if God sees as a man sees. If God were like a man and had eyes like a man, Job would understand why God would have to look carefully at Job to discern what's going on with him, similar to his friends. Perhaps we get a glimpse of what's happening on the facial gestures of their friends as they're having this conversation. As they look at Job, they can't quite discern what's going on, so they just look at him and blame him for everything and believe that he's at fault. And so perhaps in them, he sees probing eyes trying to discern the nature of his own evilness. But God isn't like man. God doesn't have eyes like man, and no, God doesn't see as man sees. He sees all, and he knows all. Nothing is hidden from his sight. Because of these things, though, Job tells God in verse 7 that it is not right for him to watch him as he does. God should already know that he has no sin and that he deserves no such treatment. But in any case, Job also knows that he is powerless before this God and none can deliver from his hand. Thus, since God knows of his innocence and is still allowing him to suffer in this way, do you hear what he's saying? God is unjust. God is unjust to allow these things to happen. That's the second question. The third question is in verse 8-17. Why did you create me? Follow along as I read this. Your hands fashioned and made me, and now you have destroyed me altogether. Remember that you have made me like clay, and will you return me to the dust? Did you not pour me out like milk and curdle me like cheese? You clothed me with skin and flesh and knit me together with bones and sinews. You have granted me life and steadfast love, and your care has preserved my spirit. Yet these things you hid in your heart. I know that this was your purpose. If I sin, you watch me and do not acquit me of my iniquity. If I am guilty, woe to me. If I am in the right, I cannot lift up my head, for I am filled with disgrace and look upon my affliction. And were my head lifted up, you would hunt me like a lion and again work wonders against me. You renew your witnesses against me and increase your vexation toward me. You bring fresh troops against me. Remember back in verse 3, look back up a little bit. Job mentioned that he was the work of God's hands. And here in verse 8-17, he expands on that very theme more. These verses are such a mixed bag, aren't they? They're such a contrast. They're a mix, one commentator said, of the beautiful and the horrible. It's mixed because Job is mixed. As God intimately created him, God is now intimately destroying him. God carefully formed him in the womb from clay, and God is now reversing the creation process and returning him to the dust from which he was made. And Job says, what's the point of creating me if my end was going to be like this? I know that this was your purpose all along. He speaks of this creative work of God with him like that of slowly curdling milk to make cheese. In verse 10, clothing him and knitting him together in verse 11, even granting him life, steadfast love, and preservation in verse 12. Yet, verse 13 reveals that Job remains vexed because God's purpose in making him so carefully only seems to be to unmake him so cruelly at the appointed time. Now, God only watches him. He does not forgive him. He fills him with disgrace. And if he were to have strength to peek up his head, Job says he would hunt him down like a lion. And once he got him, work wonders against him. Or as verse 17 describes it, Job believes God increases his vexation by besieging him with army upon army upon army, with waves and waves and waves of fresh, invigorated troops. It's a pretty intense middle section. Now, this is all leading to a culminating point with the last question in verse 18 to 22. Why don't you kill me? Job says. Why did you bring me out from the womb? Would that I had died before any eye had seen me, and were as though I had not been carried from the womb to the grave. Are not my days few? Then cease and leave me alone that I may find a little cheer before I go, and I shall not return to the land of darkness and deep shadow, to the land of gloom like thick darkness, like deep shadow without any order, where light is as thick darkness. In a very real sense, Job now comes back to the themes that he lamented on in chapter 3. That's why I think chapter 10 and 3 are so intimately connected. He cracked first, and then he experienced one of the cycles, almost one of the cycles of speeches from his friends. And he's showing evidence of more cracking. He wishes that he never lived. But because he's alive and suffering so, his wish is that God would leave him alone. And if that happened, Job believes that if God left him alone, that that would give Job cheer or a little bit of rest in this fallen, horrible, quick life. Where literally in the Hebrew, it's interesting there. We saw earlier in the verses where he critiqued God of smiling at the designs of the wicked. Here, literally, Job would find cheer or smile in peaceful rest. And so there may be in the original language here something about the smile of God that is hidden in the midst of clouds. It could give us the perception that God does not smile, but frowns at us and robs us of all smile. Therefore, the only thing that could give us a little smile is his absence. Though his beginnings were full of order and beauty, his present life is quickly fading into nothing but disorder and chaos. But listen to how Christopher Ashe, our commentator, ends chapter 10 with this beam of hope. Job mentions some pretty dark stuff in chapter 10, and yet deep in his heart is the question, why? Job addresses this question to the God who seems to him to be such a monster. And in this question, and in that address, lies the hope of chapter 10. Whatever Job says, the fact that he says it to God, and the fact that he says it with such vehemence, suggests that Job knows he has not reached the end of his quest for meaning. So there is in Job the inner energy of faith, the mark of a real believer. Job may be wrong in his persuasion of God and in the reality of his situation, but he is deeply right in his heart and in the direction of his yearning questioning. Thank God for that.